Accession number 23329, Reel 5.
Cal Younger, Reel 5.
I got through that night somehow, and in the morning I was taken to another building, had some sort of a breakfast, I can't remember now what. I was very anxious to get a razor because I was afraid that they would see that I was almost clean shaven when I should have had a week's growth. But they wouldn't give me one, nor would they give me needle and thread to sew my various badges and stripes back on. And we set off for the station, waited on the platform for quite some time, and then they looked at the timetable, which was on the wall, and they realised there weren't any trains on Sundays. So back we went, and we got in a car. And they said something about shooting me, and I thought that's what they were going to do. I probably looked a little concerned, and I was then assured that they were only going to shoot me if I tried to escape. And they put their rifles in the car, and we drove up to Paris. And they said, "You're going to be a prisoner for quite a long time. So would you like to see the sights of Paris?" And so they drove me around, just pointing out the sights, like the Arc de Triomphe and the Tower Eiffel and so on. And then right in the heart of Paris, the car broke down for some reason. And so I sat in the back seat while they got out, and they also got a couple of Germans who were riding past on bicycles, and they pushed the car, the crowd looking curiously at me in the back, thinking I must be at least an admiral, otherwise I'd be out pushing. They got me to Luftwaffe headquarters. I was taken to the office of an Oberst, or colonel. He was on the telephone, so there was a comfortable armchair, and I sat in that, and the colonel put the phone down, saw me in the armchair, and got me out of it pretty smart. Then he was shown the things that had been taken from me, actually things like the water bottle and the tobacco, which of course I'd kept because I had my pipe. And so he looked through those, and I had a razor blade in a little folding metal container, rather like a pocket knife. I could lift the blade out. And so I took the opportunity to say that I had used it to shave during the time I was on the loose. I just dry shaved myself. I felt I had to explain why I didn't have a week's growth. That was the mistake, of course, that I made in allowing the barber to shave me. I had made another mistake too, which fortunately they didn't see, and that was that the tobacco in my tobacco pouch was French tobacco. Later on the train, one of my three guards asked when I lit up, is that English tobacco? So I said, yes. So they smelt it and said, oh, yes, that's English. But it wasn't. So again, I could have been caught. I was then taken down from the colonel's office to a cell downstairs, and I spent the rest of the day there, and I was interrogated by a young German officer who told me that my crew were dead, except for Godfrey Loder, my rear gunner, that he was a prisoner, which delighted me, and also that John Holborough, who had been the rear gunner in the other Wellington from 460 Squadron, was also a prisoner. The rest of his crew had been killed. What the interrogator was on about was who had helped me, and I didn't feel that I could just stick to name, rank and number. I did have to give some sort of explanation. I don't know whether he believed me. I did say some silly things, like I'd taken carrots from a field. As this was the end of May, I don't think there would have been carrots, but he didn't know either. At one point he said that since I didn't have my stripes and brevity up, they might very well take me out and shoot me as a spy. And he said that German prisoners were being grossly ill-treated in Africa. And I said to him, you speak English very well. And he said, yes, I was at Oxford. And I said, well, the officers who you claim are committing atrocities on your people in Africa were probably friends of yours at Oxford. And he said, good point, and he left it. And so I got through the interrogation all right. I was then given a piece of black bread and taken to a railway station by three German soldiers, Stefan, August and Theodor. And we went across to Germany. They had the previous week taken Godfrey Loder and John Holborough. They referred to Godfrey as the one with the big moustache, and John Holborough to the one with the wounded leg. We got to Frankfurt, not without incident, because we were occupying a compartment, the four of us, three guards and myself, in a crowded train, and people were getting quite angry standing in the corridors. Here was an Englishman, as they thought, a prisoner, comfortably sitting when they were having to stand. Eventually, the guards did allow an elderly couple to come in, and I remember the lady took a fancy to my Australian issue flying boots, which had a lovely wool lining. She was leaning forward and feeling them. We got to Frankfurt station, and I persuaded the guards to take me to the restaurant on the station, and I saw a Canadian airman in the charge of some other German soldiers, and he told me later that the Germans had refused to take him to the wasn't really a restaurant, a cafe, I suppose, until they saw that mine were taking me there, so he was allowed to go as well. And from there, we went on the tram to Dulag Luft at Oberursel. On the tram, there was a German girl reading Vanity Fair. And I said, are you enjoying that? She said, yes, she was. And the guards looked slightly surprised, but didn't say anything. And we got to Dulag Luft, and the three guards said goodbye to me in quite a friendly way. And they'd given me bits of their food, because I hadn't taken the bread with me. It looked so awful. I just left it, which was a mistake, because I didn't realize I was going to have a couple of days on the train. From there. There were times when they did eat from their rations without offering me any, and on those occasions invariably they apologized. Sorry. Trying to think. On the trip from Paris had been quite friendly, so it was a bit of a shock when I was handed over to Germans who were not nearly so friendly. I was taken to a cell, small cell, left to myself, door clanged, and I had a sense of absolute blankness and a feeling of being emptied. There weren't even any bugs to tame. There weren't any nails in the floorboards that I could count. I was left to my thoughts. My clothes were taken away, and I was issued temporarily with a Polish uniform and clogs. Now, I wasn't very happy with the clogs at all. I thought that the Germans would have found my maps and the file in my boot when they took my clothes away for examination rather than searching on me. And I was very surprised that they were still there when I got my own clothes back. As I said before, they ended up with the escape committee at Stalag Luft 3. We had been briefed on the squadron, of course, about being a prisoner, what to expect, and we had been warned about the bogus Red Cross officer who brought a questionnaire that one was asked to fill in, which had quite a lot of questions that no patriotic prisoner could possibly answer, but it was quite astonishing what they knew. Somebody did a cartoon of an interrogator saying, "And how is your wing commander's daughter Penelope?" And it was almost on that scale. They did know who one's CO was and so on. Anyway, this particular officer did have a list of people from my squadron, 460 squadron, who had been shot down, and he said the names with the crosses on are dead and the others are prisoners. One of the ones with a cross was the navigator of the flight commander's aircraft, Squadron Leader Gilbert. And this navigator was Jack Shearer, who had been with me from the day we joined the Air Force. And he was one of 10 of us who managed to stay together. We crossed to England on the same ship. We went to 27 OTU at Lichfield, and except for two who were killed there, we went on to 460 Squadron. So, and Jack had gone, and we had the little rhyme, 10 little navigators, and as each one went, it was rather like the 10 little nigger boys. I was told that at this point there, I remember going back to Paris, I mentioned Squadron Leader Gilbert. The interrogator in Paris kept asking me, did I know Squadron Leader Gibert? And I couldn't get it. Eventually, I came out with it. I said, "You mean Gilbert?" I thought to myself, "Well, I've given that away." But of course, they had the name all the time in Germany. The French, or rather the interrogator in Paris, it turned out, had been given the navigator's log from the other aircraft from our squadron, which had survived the crash and the fire and had been picked up. And the navigators had kept several logs that he had set up prior to a flight, and the flight had then been cancelled, and obviously Squadron Leader Gilbert's name had appeared on one of those logs. And it was surprising how much the Germans discovered from the wreckage of aircraft. Things that paper you wouldn't really expect to survive, but it did very often, and that was one way they obtained quite a lot of information. Anyway, coming back to my interrogation, they were very interested in G, which was the first of the radar navigational aids. We didn't have it. I knew nothing about it anyway. But I didn't. He called it a green glass. Or green grass, I've forgotten which. I'd never heard of it under that name anyway. He showed me a photograph of it, and I said, well, what is it, a radio? I literally didn't know what it was myself. And he said, oh, well, we knew that Wellington 4s were not equipped with G, with green grass. So a day or two later, I was sent over to the main compound. Is this a gap? While I was on the loose in France, there were 3,000 bomber raids. The first one took place the night after I was shot down. So there were more prisoners than usual at that time, and the cells were needed for fresh prisoners coming in, which I think was the main reason why I wasn't kept longer. In the Gulag Luft itself, we met a few new friends. There weren't any that I knew. Both Godfrey and John Albert had already gone on to Stalag III. But I did meet Peter Butterjig, a Maltese who had been brought up in Gibraltar. He was a rear gunner, and he'd stayed in the burning aircraft long enough to shoot down the fighter that got them. I always thought he should have got a DFM for that. He was a delightful man, and still a great friend of mine today. I was drawing him. We were sitting down by the fence when Group Captain Massey came up to see what I was doing, and he stayed to chat. He became a senior British officer at Stalag III. He had been about to go to America give the Americans some idea of what Bomber Command was doing, and thought he ought to take a trip himself, just so that he'd know what he was talking about. He was really a First World War veteran. So he flew as second pilot, and unhappily they were shot down. And he actually hid in a chicken shed for some time before he was captured. Not quite what you would expect for a group captain of First World War vintage. I made more friends on the train to Sagan, where Stalag III was situated. Once there were about 70 prisoners at Gulag Luft. They were shunted off to other prison camps. At that time, almost all to Stalag Luft 3, which had been specially built for Air Force prisoners. But it was soon full, so we were one of the very last contingents to arrive. Anyway, on the train, which was not, we were not in the cattle trucks that we were in later journeys, but we were in an ordinary train with ordinary compartments. The windows had been wired up but left just a few inches at the top. In my compartment, there were two Canadians. One was Tom Miller, Thomas Breach Miller, always known as TB. He was he's wearing a uniform that was yellow with the fluorescence that he'd picked up in the sea, having been shot down in a Halifax on his first trip after 6 months in hospital with burns sustained when he was shot down over England, either by a German night fighter or possibly one of our own. And he was the only conscious member of the crew after the crash, and he got all the rest of the crew out and was awarded the George Medal, the first Canadian ever to get a George Medal. The other Canadian was Cyril Tobias, always known as Toby, who had infectious humour and kept us all amused on that journey. Most of his humour was turned against himself in some way. Then there was Dick Vernon, who I didn't take to immediately, but later became probably my best friend in Germany. On that trip, T.B. Miller made paper darts and lit them and propelled them through the gap in the window, trying to blow up an ammunition train that was drawn up alongside. He didn't succeed, and fortunately wasn't caught. We eventually arrived at Sagan and were marched to the camp and taken first to a hut outside the main camp in the Vorlager. Godfrey Loder saw me and shouted, and then got himself on a coffee party and brought buckets of coffee to us, and so I had an opportunity to speak to him and to tell him that the rest of the crew had not survived. He had worried that maybe we'd got home. I quite understood that, because I had that sort of worry too, even though I'd actually seen the aircraft plunge into the earth. And so he was, in a way, relieved that I turned up to assure him that he wasn't the only one who'd landed and been left.